This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
I'm coming! Nobody can stop me. Nobody can hold me. Nobody can control me. I'm coming! I'm here to do my thing. I'm here to bring the pain. I'm never ever gonna change. I'm coming!
All right, Place to Be Nation. How's it going? Long time no see. This is Will from Texas, and it's been a while since I've been in the podcast game, but the Place to Be Nation is sponsoring a greatest WWE wrestler of all time poll. And I felt this would be a great time to jump back into the podcast game. And I'm going to do a little series called For Your Consideration, where we look at wrestlers from different eras, and hopefully we can give some of the highlights and some of the low points in a wrestler's career, and if we would put them on our list of greatest WWE wrestlers of all time. And for this show, we're going to focus on the mid-2000 era. And everybody on this list is no longer with the company. What era would you call this, guys? Would you call this a toothless aggression, post-attitude? Steve, let's go with you.
This is the dogs are in the enclosed pool era.
There you go. What about you? What would you consider?
Oh, goodness. How do I follow that? I mean, it's roughly the Cena era, but the Cena era isn't over and we're not talking about him tonight. Spoilers.
But it's true. It's the rise of Cena. It's the Cena era. That's a good point. So, you know, we're looking roughly guys who made their name between 2005, 2012. You know, maybe a little earlier, maybe a little later, but they are no longer the company. And it took me a while because, you know, I'm a long-winded host, but I'm here with Glenn Butler, who used to host the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour. You haven't done one of those in a few months, but you can still see him on every Wednesday at Place to Be Nation with the Wednesday Walk Around the Web. Glenn, what's going on, buddy?
Not much. I'm actually thinking a little bit about new episodes of the Spectacular, but that's on the horizon a little bit. Thank you very much. I am glad to be here tonight.
All right, and we're also here with my buddy Steve Williams. I met Steve at WrestleMania in Dallas last year, and we also went to the IWA Mid-South 20th anniversary show, you know? So I had a great time, and for those who don't know, Steve won the Place to Be Nation wrestling trivia contest, which I did miserable in.
Sadly, I was second place in that competition. I don't want to claim any unjust.
What the hell, dude? I thought you ran the table.
I ran the table on the second to last round, and then I got stumped because I could not remember all four of Jesse Ventura's children's names.
You're kidding me.
Jeremiah got me in the end, man. It was I think the game was rigged personally, maybe a little Northeast bias, but you know, what can I do? Jack Tunney's on the case.
No, I can believe that, man. When I went to go visit JT in Rhode Island, they treated me like a little bastard stepchild, made me sleep outside in the middle of the winter, so that wasn't cool.
But that's what they do.
Yeah. Anyway.
That's northern hospitality we have so much of up here.
Oh, you definitely feel it too, man, because people are much nicer in the South, man. That's why I love Texas. So anyway, but all right, so let's get on. So guys, each of us picked some wrestlers we wanted to talk about. Not everybody on here is a contender for like the top 20 or whatever, but we're going to decide, like, should this person be on the list or not? And so, Glenn, we're going to start with you. One of the wrestlers you picked was Mickey James, okay? And so, first off, why did you pick Mickey James? And two, I want you to kind of run down some of her career highlights and low points in her WWE career.
Well, one of the reasons I chose Mickey James when we were talking about who we would cover on this show was because I wanted us to have at least one woman on the list, because there's been a lot of discussion about how many women are getting on your list, where are you going to rank them, do you have to grade them on a curve, and I think Mickey James is a person who's interesting to talk about in that light, because like a few other people who were at the forefront of the women's division during the 2000s and up to just a couple of years ago, there was this dynamic going on where they had one, maybe two women who were solid, good wrestlers, and everyone else was like a trainee who was a model 6 months ago. Or, you know, someone similar, someone who maybe came in through the diva search and didn't have the natural wrestling talent. And some of those got better, and some of those got trained up, and there are discussions to have there, too. But the place that Mickie James was in is the place that Trish Stratus was in for a substantial part of her career, and that Lita was in for a good part of her career, and AJ Lee, where they were the one who could wrestle. And so Mickie James spent a lot of time putting together what she could with the Melinas and the Michelle McCools of the world, for whom I'm sure there are great fans, but I'm not one. And so I think it's interesting to think about, on a list like this, how much you weigh the comparatively few opportunities she had to really stand out in matches with other people who could really go. Some of her matches with Beth Phoenix, the match, obviously, with Trish Stratus at WrestleMania 22, had some great moments, had some great build coming up to it, too, with Mickie James really, like, buying into the stalker character, which is easy to just be boring and bland.
A much better stalker than DDP or Barry Windham.
Yes, absolutely, yes. And this is the one person I think we're talking about tonight who actually is back in the company now. She came back with a stellar, stellar match against Asuka at an NXT show last November, which I think really, really showcases not only some growth that she's had since she left the company, but also a sort of women's match that they really don't put on, where both of them were over the age of 40 and had all of that experience and had all of that background and still had a very physical, like a tough, hard-hitting match. The strikes that they landed were amazing, and a lot of the physicality was just amazing for the two of them, and really, really adds to her case, I think.
Wait, time out. She's back in the company?
Yeah, dude, she came back in November.
So one wrestler in, and we already blew my gimmick of not having career wrestlers. That's fine, man.
You know, until Glenn mentioned that, I had forgotten that she was back.
Well, maybe it doesn't count as much toward her case as I thought.
Obviously, I did too, or I would have vetoed her, you know. It's okay. Because really, the strength of her being on any list is going to be what she did before she left to be a country singer, right? I mean, that's the reality, right?
Well, if you want to consider longevity and you want to consider, like, the real meat of her career, then, yeah, the stuff in her first run is going to weigh a little heavier. I just think that one match with Asuka, like, the night that she came back in the company, she instantly had her best match.
Okay. So, that's a fair point. I feel so bad that you picked Mickie James, because all the other wrestlers I have opinions of. But with her, every time I saw her live, right, and I saw her live maybe two or three times, she was my restroom break, man. It was like, ooh, Mickie James looks nice tonight. Okay, going to the restroom. And I wouldn't even watch the matches, you know. And it was really, maybe it was just because it was Mickie James. It wasn't just because it was Mickie James wrestling. It just happened to be like the women's match came on. It was a restroom break. And trust me, I wasn't the only one, because the restrooms were always packed during the women's matches in that time, you know.
Yeah, and I know. That's the way they treated it for years and years and years.
You know? And so to me, like, that's kind of my biggest problem, is that I had such a low regard for the women's division during her run that, you know, besides the Trish feud, I didn't really look at her as having a lot of highlights. But, like, there were other things. Like, didn't they used to call her Piggy James?
That is on my list of lowlights, yes. I mean, that's booking. That's not, like, her in a talent level, but
oh, absolutely.
That was definitely
misogynist.
Yes, absolutely. That was pretty terrible. And I mean, some of the other lowlights in terms of matches, I would really put on her competition. But again, that's something that you have to weigh in something like this. She doesn't have a deep, deep catalog. She has, you know, the Trish match, the Asuka match, some Beth Phoenix matches, maybe one match with Natalya. But like I said, the opportunity to kind of showcase her talent with someone on an equal level was a little lacking.
Okay. And Steve, do you have anything you want to add to Mickie James here?
I kind of look at the women's matches from that era in a similar mindset as you guys did, as far as, you know, they weren't really all that important. They were more eye candy for the most part. However, the quality of that Mickie Trish feud in the beginning of 2006 was such that it made you look past that. It was arguably the best feud of the promotion at the time. It was right up there with, I would say, Edge and Foley in quarter one of 06. It was the only thing that was comparable to it. So just the fact that their character work and their matches were able to elevate their status above the usual spot in the card, I think really says a lot about her strength as a performer, at least during that first part. Now, as time dragged on, it did, you know, she did fall by the wayside a bit as she lost opponents. You know, Trish obviously went by the wayside. Victoria disappeared at one point, and you started to get a promotion filled with Diva Search castoffs. So just the company as a whole, as far as women went, was pretty damn hopeless from 2007 on, in my opinion, until this newer crop of NXT girls popped up.
Okay. Let me ask you, Steve, before we move on to the next guy, Mickie James, any shot on making your list of 100?
It's unlikely. If she did make it in, it would be a bottom 10 entry for sure.
Oh, okay. It was like you just said all these glowing things about her. And it was like, yeah, no shot.
I mean, so, as my good friend Eric Nelson has said on many occasions, being the best woman wrestler in 2006 is the equivalent of being the prettiest waitress at Denny's. I mean, what are you really winning in the end?
Hey, I dated a waitress from Denny's once, man.
Of course you did, Will. Of course you did.
Hey, you know, she was probably the best looking waitress. She was probably the only one that was under the age of 30 also. And there was like this gap, right, where it was like,
in her teeth?
You know. There is definitely gaps in the teeth. Not for her, but like, dude, she had to have been like, what, maybe 20, 21 years old. And then the next youngest waitress was like 52. Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
Anyway, Glenn, where is she going to rank for you, man? High, low, middle? Where's she going?
Probably around the high end of the back half of the list. In a subset of the women that I'm considering for my list, she's pretty high on that list because she has the longevity a little more than some of the Women's Revolution people who are current. But she is kind of limited by the back catalog.
Right. Okay. Well, yeah, she has no shot at making my list. Sorry. I'm kind of sexist when it comes to my wrestling. It's like, you can't hang. But, you know, no, I enjoyed Mickie James. I enjoyed looking at her. So that was a plus. Anyway, let's move on. So, Steve, you picked MVP, okay? I can't even pronounce his name. Something, something Porter. Montavious Von Porter, or what was the middle?
It was Montel Vontavious Porter.
There you go. Okay, I knew it was on MVP. Yeah, I'm not going to call him whatever you just said. All right. So, now, MVP for me, I kind of have a mixed emotions about MVP. Is I always feel like here's a guy, like when you listen to him talk on his podcast or in previous podcast, like a guy who has passion for wrestling, a guy who wanted to be a good wrestler, a guy who wanted to like watch Japanese tapes and learn to be a great wrestler, like those great Japanese wrestlers. I just never felt he was like a great wrestler, and it just kind of like made me sad because I really thought that the character started off really strong. I mean, that was the era of Terrell Owens and Cinco Ocho over there in Cincinnati, you know, and he kind of embodied that, but I just don't think that he was the right guy to pull it off in the ring. But having said that, I'm going to let you talk about MVP and like, you know, the highlights of his WWE run and, you know, the low points as well. So the floor is yours.
All right, looking back at when MVP debuted, I believe that was the summer, maybe fall of 2006. He was just without question, the most contemporary character they had debuted in quite some time. It didn't quite make sense that they would be offering this huge mega contract to a guy who was working in a bodysuit. But once he got the ball, I mean, I thought he ran with it from a character standpoint. Those first few months, I didn't think he was worth much in the ring. And it's going to sound terrible to say in 2017. But the minute he won me over was when he wrestled Kane in that Inferno match, and he was willing to get his ass caught on fire.
No. I thought, man,
how dare you mention that name?
Oh, trust me. We're going to talk a lot about Kane on this series, this podcast series.
I thought, man, this guy's willing to do that much to get over. You know, he's worth another look. And then the feud with Matt Hardy, which was kind of stifled in the sense that he was not allowed to wrestle at that time. He had been diagnosed with a heart condition. But it was one of the few times when the creative team actually came up with something decent by being more creative. They had the weekly contest, pizza eating one week. They shot basketball hoops another week. Just week after week of silly shit to help flesh out that relationship. And then he had to go and screw it all up by making some joke in front of the drug testing people or some nonsense and got jobbed out for the rest of his run. I didn't think he was a bad wrestler at all. He was kind of formulaic, kind of almost like a WWE creator wrestler would have been at that time with his moveset. But I really think that had he been allowed to run with it a little bit longer before they started jobbing him out, he could have been something special given more time.
Yeah, and maybe that's the problem, though, right? Is that with a list like this, it's not, you know, what could have happened, right? Like, what if, right. What if somebody didn't get injured or whatever, you know? What if somebody else, you know, was allowed to show their true personality instead of, you know, reading off this scripted nonsense that they have these days? You know, I mean, there's a lot of woulda, coulda, shouldas, but with MVP, I just feel let me dial this back a little bit. What would be like his best match? Like if you were to say, hey, this besides the Kane match, because we ought to automatically eliminate that one, what match would you tell people to go to the network and watch if you wanted them to see MVP's highlights?
I remember enjoying the month after WrestleMania 2008. I think the show was still Backlash, where he wrestled Matt Hardy and finally dropped the U.S. title to him. The other thing that kind of sidetracked that feud I'd completely forgotten about was MVP had just got over the heart ailment, and then Matt Hardy all of a sudden ended up with, I think it was appendicitis, and was out for several months. So just a run of bad luck for those guys. But then he had a decent opener with Jeff Hardy at SummerSlam that year, right when Jeff was just starting to get his groove back coming off his wellness suspension in the middle of 2008.
Okay, that sounds fair. And you know, before the Benoit tragedy, he even had some good matches with Benoit too. Glenn, any hot takes on MVP?
Well, a few minutes ago, we were talking about how Mickie James held down the women's division in 2006, and that might be a dubious accomplishment. MVP held down the SmackDown mid-card in 2008.
Yes.
He grew into a decent wrestler. Eventually, a little while after his debut, with the matches with Benoit, a lot of the stuff with Hardy, some of the other stuff in the SmackDown midcard, really, really got listless when they moved him over to Raw. I remember he had a feud with The Miz for the U.S. title, which was just god-awful. They had awful matches, the promos were awful, it was not a good time. I kind of liked his tag team with Mark Henry when he was on Raw, but he was really listless by then and never really kind of clicked into that groove where, you know, he would regularly have good promos and good matches. So he just kind of falls off the end of the list as far as I'm concerned.
Okay, yeah, and he has no shot at making my list, so there we go. Steve, before we move on to the next guy, is he going to be on your list, or is he just someone you're considering?
He could sneak into the bottom quarter of my list, absolutely.
Okay. Well, you're much more kinder gentleman than I am. But so let's go to one of my personal favorites. This is someone I would put in my guilty pleasure category, although my buddy Dylan Hells would say that he was a good wrestler, that he was worth watching, and that's Ryback. Okay. And I enjoyed the Ryback character, man. I enjoyed his bully character that he did, where he would, like, you know, bully people backstage and then tell people, turn around and tell people he wasn't a bully. I thought he was a really good tag guy. You know, he took, I want to say he took Curtis Axel, right? Like, he was the worker in the group, but he made a tag team with Curtis Axel work, you know. You know, to where they had, like, really good matches. I remember being front row at a TLC 2013, and he was part of that four-man elimination tag that also had Goldust and Cody, Big Show and Ray. And was the other team Cesaro and Swagger in that match? Does that sound right? Sounds right. Yeah, let's just go with that. The group. I thought, you know, if you look at Ryback, clearly when he had that feud with Punk that led to the undefeated streak versus the title, you know, it popped a buy rate, man. People genuinely didn't know if he was going to win or not. You know, had a horrible finish in the match, but the feud clearly worked from a business level. And then, you know, if you talk to Punk, he'll say that he's one of the worst, most dangerous, careless wrestlers ever. And I saw him have a good match with Daniel Bryan at a live event as well. So he definitely has the angles. He has the feuds. He was part of the great Shield versus Ryback and Team Hell No match at a TLC. What was it? The year before? Was it 2014? I think maybe
2012.
Okay, I'm horrible with dates, man. So. You know, so he has highlights to his career, but you know, the Kalisto matches. Steve, you were at that WrestleMania in Dallas. You know, I don't know if you got in on time, but my crew was still waiting in line to get into the stadium when Kalisto and Ryback wrestled. Did you actually make it into the stadium?
Yes. Two of the members of my party made it in. The other four did not make it till later. They were having too much fun at the tailgate.
Oh, there you go.
But yes, that was a shockingly entertaining little match.
Yeah, and they had like several. Like, it wasn't just like one match. Like, they had several good matches. So
I know that the next month, they think it was those same two guys wrestled on the pre-show again, and Ryback actually had the tights that said pre-show stopper airbrushed on the back.
See, and he got it too, man. And you could tell, like, once those things, once that appeared on his tights, man, you knew he wasn't long for the company, man.
Right.
Anyway, Glenn, yeah, you have any thoughts on Ryback?
Hoofa doofa. I am not a fan of Skip Sheffield in the least. He has no shot at making my list. I have not enjoyed, like, any of his matches, aside from maybe that one Kalisto one. Far as I'm concerned, the best segment he's ever been involved in was when Kevin Owens threw the secret in his face. He was a large part of that Intercontinental title Elimination Chamber, which completely fell apart and was completely terrible.
Hold on. Is that the one where Mark Henry's, like, entire plate of glass fell off?
Yes.
Dude, that wasn't his fault that plate of glass fell off, man.
It wasn't his fault the plate of glass fell off, but that entire match fell apart and no one managed to do anything to put it back together. You could count that against all of them. I count it particularly against Skip Sheffield just because I hate him.
Yeah, okay. Okay, so no shot at your list. Man, now see, because I was undecided on Ryback on my list, but now that you have deemed him not worthy of the list, I'm going to put him at like 49, like right above Undertaker.
Anyway. Hey, I understand making decisions based on spite. I totally get it.
That's funny, man. Okay, Steve, any thoughts on Ryback?
Anything after 2012 and before that Kalisto match, I just did not enjoy at all. I enjoyed him as the shorter, wider version of Bill Goldberg, especially when they were doing the gimmick of naming the jobbers just the most random ass thing they could come up with every week.
Oh, yeah. Rutherford P.S. Hayes. That was incredible. Yes.
I think he wrestled Millard Fillmore one week.
Yes.
And it's not entirely their fault that Cena got hurt and Ryback got plugged into that Hell in the Cell where they pretty much had to job him out with the handsome referee punching him in the balls or whatever it was that happened. But yeah, anything after that, really after that Shield TLC match, just his whole 2013 was just dog shit to me. And I like the guy. I mean, personally, I was backstage on ROH show where he was trying to get work when he got cut years ago, when Gabe just had this oh shit look on his face, like, no, you're you're the size of four of my guys, I can't use you.
See, that's the difference between a Gabe and a Paul Heyman, because Paul Heyman had 9-1-1 and made it work.
He had fucking Sid Vicious choke slamming John Cronus. I mean,
yeah, man, come on, exactly. You know, I mean, actually, if you look at, I wonder, is like Ryback bigger than Moose? Because they made Moose work, right? You know,
well, but
I know Gabe was wrong by then, gone by then.
Yeah, this would have been the 2000, is actually the same weekend as the Benoit situation. So that would have been the summer of 2007.
Oh, I thought you meant like when he got like released like a couple of years ago or something.
No, no, I haven't been anywhere near backstage in a wrestling show in 10 years.
Oh, I guess a couple of years ago, Gabe wouldn't have been backstage either.
Right.
No.
So sad, man. I was a history teacher for so long and I don't know my history, man. Go anyway. All right. Well, right back. Okay, check this out. I have 17 guys I'm considering for the last four spots on my list, and Ryback is still in contention on that spot. Okay, so he's like I said, he's like one of those guilty pleasure guys. So I don't know where he's going to end up, but he's there. Okay, so Glenn, let's go to the next wrestler, and this is a guy I got plenty to say about, and I'm sure Steve does too, and that's Umaga. Okay, and so like, what about Umaga appeals to you? You know, like clearly, we know about the John Cena Royal Rumble match. I was there live. It was awesome live. It was awesome on replay. But what else about Umaga would make him one of the top 100 guys in the WWE?
Well, I think it's something of an accomplishment to make the Samoan Savage gimmick work in the 2000s without being just cringeworthy and morally reprehensible. And so the way that he worked, the balance that you have to do in that gimmick between being a dominant monster and strategically showing vulnerability to put over your opponent was something he was really, really good at during that run. Obviously, there's the John Cena match. Everybody knows about the Jeff Hardy matches, the cage match on Raw, the street fight, the Falls Count Anywhere match. He had some good matches with CM Punk toward the end of his run. And for Jeff Hardy and for Punk, he acted as sort of like a gateway to the upper card. And he really kind of inhabited that space once he was done with his title shots and such. He did have some lowlights. There was the WrestleMania 24 match with Batista that was not as good as it should have been because they did not have chemistry. Awesome.
That was fun, man. Those guys beat the shit out of each other. I disagree. I had to, actually, on my notes here, I have highlights. Batista Mania match.
Well, all right. There's the Triple H match at that No Mercy, I think, which also was not as good as it should have been, but I know you've got a lot to say about Triple H on another show. Obviously, he doesn't have promos, yeah.
Wait. Hold on, man. This is how much I hate Triple H, man.
Okay.
Like, I'm writing, like, essays on why he's on this list. Like, I figured, you know, after time, you know, he only shows up once or twice a year, you know, that my feelings towards this guy would soften. They haven't, man. I still hate him. Like, I'm sorry. All right. Continue your thoughts.
Obviously, in the Umaga run, he has no promos, which is kind of the point. And so I think the way he plays the character comes out more in his mannerisms while his manager was doing his promos and mannerisms during the match. And he really, really hit on the character, bought into it completely in those ways. I think as far as making the list, I think he's in the back half, but still with some respect.
I agree completely, and I have him like somewhere, you know, between the 60 and 80 range. Like, I haven't figured it out, but Like, I have him up there, man. Like, I really like the character. And, you know, let's not forget, he was also part of 3 Minute Warning, you know, where I don't think 3 Minute Warning had any, like, right? He was one of the brothers in 3 Minute Warning, right? Him and the other guy?
Yeah, the only reason I didn't mention that is because that era is kind of a blind spot for me.
Okay, but him and, yeah, but it was him and Rosie, right? Like, I'm not making that up?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so, like, I don't remember that 3 Minute Warning having, like, any good matches, but I kind of like them coming out of the blue, you know, and just, like, beating the hell out of people, you know, doing their, like, flying Samoan drop thing. But anyway, Steve, thoughts on Umaga?
3 Minute Warning was fun because they were just big, fat, sloppy, stiff bastards. So that, just watching them wreck shop was a nice little few-month run. I was kind of with Glenn on the Samoan Savage when he debuted. I'm just watching, shaking my head at why the hell would they think this works in 2006. But man, credit to him. They got him over as hell, made him this indestructible monster until he ran into Cena, and those Cena matches were, again, incredible. That visual of John Cena getting choked out with that rope is something I'm never going to forget in my life. And as far as I'm concerned, Jeff Hardy owes that family 20 cents of every dollar he makes for the rest of his life. Umaga did so much to get Jeff Hardy over in that feud that is just unreal.
Oh, okay, but let's be fair, man. Jeff Hardy had been over for like 7 years straight.
Like, Jeff Hardy was high for 6 of those years, sir.
Well, that's neither here nor there.
Whole 7.
Now, you're talking about the 7 years before that. He was passing out trying to wrestle Sting in the fucking Impact Zone, man. This was the Jeff Hardy renaissance.
No.
You're right. I got my timeline mixed up. My fault.
Dude, he was so despondent about Umaga, the Umaga feud, that he had to get high because he was still having Umaga nightmares in TNA.
So every time he made Jeff Hardy rich, and then he brought his life crashing down, is what you're telling
every
me.
Every time I close my eyes, I see that thumb.
Yeah, that's exactly what it, no, man.
But, yeah, he definitely has a chance of making the list under my my personal favorites section.
Now let me ask you this: like, did y'all ever hear that story that like they were going to give Samoa Joe the Umaga deal, but he turned it down or something? That
yes, sir, that's definitely the rumor.
Yeah, the timeline adds up because supposedly they're looking at Punk and Joe, and Joe ends up in TNA. Punk ends up taking the WWE deal.
Right, and at the time, I know people were like, "Oh, you know." Joe made the right move, blah blah blah. And then when there was a cartoon, you know, like where I guess Joe was like in a low point in TNA, you know, after like the Kurt Angle feud, and there Punk was with the WWE title, you know, and it was just kind of like a glaring, you know, juxtaposition of where their careers were at. So, anyway, so yeah, I think I'm in the same boat, man. I think I have Umaga, like I said, in the top 100, Not high. I just don't think he had a long enough run. And, you know, I think he played the character well. And something like that, like, I'm not going to count promos against him, you know. Honestly, I don't count promos against many people who were forced to be wrestlers post 2002. Was that when it started getting really heavily scripted, 2002, 2003?
Ish, yeah.
Yeah, so I don't really... you know, old promos against just, you know, how well do they pull off the character they're trying to convey? So, yeah, Umaga. So Steve, your next guy is a guy I love, like, his shtick with, who is it? What's her name? Nadia or Nydia? What was his?
Nydia was her name.
Nydia. Okay, I don't know. You know, she didn't make the list, man. Like, I can't believe that we didn't even nominate her. So now I'm sad because I really liked looking at her.
Well, it's because you were doing the 155 nominations and you can't remember her name, so she missed the cut.
I think I did nominate Nadia, you know, and nobody knew who the hell I was talking about, so no one backed me on that. But, so that's Jamie Noble. And Jamie Noble had a great run in ROH, you know, in between stints. And I was really kind of bummed that he didn't really get the chance to shine what a great wrestler he was in WWE. You know, I was really bummed about that. I thought that he made a great hillbilly, you know, like a great white trash, you know, character. And then having Nydia there just like, you know, made, made it worth it. But I thought they were a great kind of sleazy couple, man. But I just, does he have the highlights? Does he have enough highlights and enough matches and moments to make a list like this? Talk to us.
All right, Jamie Noble was an absolute treat in 2002-2003 SmackDown. Just phenomenal character work, talking about Mineidia and all that bullshit. Went away for a while in 2005. Unfortunately, didn't do a whole lot when he came back. He was kind of stuck in a shit tag team with Kid Cash. And kind of fucked around for a long time until he was retired via a Sheamus powerbomb in storyline. But then more recently, he has been one of the goons for Seth Rollins a couple years back. Just all-time level toadying for Seth Rollins. That match at the, I think it was the Rumble, where he and Joey Mercury both took a suplex at the same time from Brock was just amazing.
Yeah, what was the name of them? Something Security. What was it?
J&J.
J&J, okay.
Just really underrated character guy. Not a whole lot of great matches, a whole lot of very good matches in that era, which unfortunately was the same time as the SmackDown 6 guys. So, you know, a lot of that stuff kind of blends together as far as great wrestling goes. But he's a sneaky contender for my list.
Yeah, I'll just say this right now. No shot at making my list, man. Although I did like Nidia. So, Glenn, talk to us.
He's not really someone I've considered that seriously. There might be some good stuff hidden, Steve, like you said, in the SmackDown era when he was in the Cruiserweight division. I mean, they had Nunzio, Paul London. I mean, they had people he could have good matches with. So that might be something to explore. I'm not sure I'm going to get the time, though, just because there really isn't that sense that there is that back catalog that I've mentioned with a couple other people. And otherwise, the first thing that comes to mind for me is his feud with Chuck Palumbo, which is not a good sign.
That's true, man. But was that during the Billy and Chuck days?
No, that was later.
Oh, God, no. It was during the Chuck Palumbo is a TLC television biker.
That's right. I remember that. Okay. See, I try to forget Chuck Palumbo, another person who was not nominated for this project. So,
yeah. If I can make a research recommendation for Jamie Noble, I would recommend the Tajiri feud, and I think it was late 2003, early 2004.
Yeah, but Tajiri is one of the best wrestlers ever, so we're going to give all the credit to Tajiri.
Was Tajiri making all these goofy-ass faces and Jamie talking his redneck shit? It unfortunately ends with Nidia being blinded, but just fun stuff.
Oh, man. Okay. Let's move on from Jamie Noble. And let's talk about one of my personal favorites. And this guy actually started much earlier. He started as a cowboy. What was he? Cowboy Bradshaw, or what was his name? Blackjack Bradshaw? Or wasn't he one of the Blackjacks?
He was Justin Hawk Bradshaw before that.
Justin Hawk Bradshaw. He did, right? Didn't him and Wyndham, didn't they form the new Blackjacks?
Yep.
Okay. See, I know a little bit, not much. And then he was a member of the APA, you know, which to me was a great tag team. Like one of the few Attitude Era acts that I really enjoyed backstage and their skits, you know, and like their bar brawls and whatever. No highlights in the ring, though. Like no matches where you say this is the APA match you really want to watch, you know. But and I'm talking about JBL, John Bradshaw Layfield. And the reason I included him in this era is, you know, this in 2004, they out of the blue, right? He had been like a nothing tag guy, member of the APA, and out of the blue, they make him J.R. Ewing, and he has a great feud with Eddie Guerrero. I guess Eddie was stressed out about being champ or something, and so JBL took the belt off Eddie in a great match too. It was the Great American Bash. Four corners, what was it called? A bull rope match, you know?
And that sounds right.
Yeah. And that was a great match. And their match, if I'm going to say, okay, watch this JBL match, I'm going to point to their Judgment Day bloodbath where Eddie Guerrero just went ape shit and lost so much blood. It was insane. That's my kind of wrestling, man. Bloody, nasty wrestling where, you know, where the hepatitis is flowing, you know, that's, I'm all about that type of run. So, but the great thing about JBL for me is that, okay, you expect him to have a good feud with Eddie because it's Eddie freaking Guerrero. You know, he's one of the best wrestlers of all time, you know, in any company. But then he has a great feud with Ray. He has a great feud with John Cena at a time before John Cena was having great feuds or great matches. And I liked his Big Show feud. Like, and he was a great week in and week out television worker. Like, no match of the year television classics or anything. But, like, I could always sit through a JBL match on SmackDown, you know? And when I look at his lowlights, I'm really struggling. Like, I mean, I guess, like, did he ever work Kane? Because it'd be easy to have a bad feud with Kane, you know? But
he did work Undertaker.
Well, I don't remember those matches. Do I need to watch the Undertaker JBL matches, Blaine?
Not if you still want to have eyeballs.
Okay. So because I don't remember those matches, like, when did those matches take place?
When he was champion in 2004, around SummerSlam was one of them.
Okay, I'm going to have to go back and watch those matches because, you know, Undertaker really shocked me with how good his casket match against Mark Henry was, so I'm going to have to look at that Undertaker feud with fresh eyes because I'm really torn on what I'm going to do with Undertaker too, you know, so I'm going to have to inspect that. But I guess the biggest lowlight is that he's an asshole in real life, right? Like, you know, he's a bully in real life and, you know, like, has to get knocked out by Joey Styles because he likes to pick on smaller announcers. And
yeah, we could use a man like Joey Styles again.
You know, makes Mauro Ranallo quit, you know. Actually, I got a story. A buddy of mine, he bullied a buddy of mine at an event. I'll tell that story for a later day. But yeah, like, he really is an asshole. Yeah. Steve, didn't he recently block you from Twitter?
Yes, he did, that fucker. I've never interacted with this guy.
What did you do to him, man?
I must have liked something Mauro said. Meltzer said that he's actively searching out tweets regarding Mauro and blocking people. It's just weird as shit. It's master's level petty. I can't deal with it, man.
Yeah, well, I guess since he's not an in-ring performer, I'm not going to hold that against him that he blocked you. But I'd understand it if it lowered him on your list a few spots. But what about his career stood out to you, man? Like, I mean, I just ran down, you know, a quick bio. So what do you think, man?
The Judgment Day 2005 match with Cena is my favorite JBL match that I quit. Absolute bloodbath. Yes. Easily the worst looking Cena's ever been as far as blood goes.
Oh, I just watched that the other night, man. That was great with where Cena rams the truck pipe into him at the end.
Oh yeah, it's great intensity out of Cena in that match.
Yep, yep, absolutely. Keep going.
On a personal level, JBL just fucked around with and plagued my dreams for a little bit. In late 2008, early 2009, I was able to get some money together and start going to big events. I went to SummerSlam 2008 and the 2009 Royal Rumble. And I'll be damned if JBL wasn't in the title match on both of those shows. So fuck him for that.
All right, what were the matches?
SummerSlam 08 was against Punk during Punk's first world title run. It was okay.
That was a four-way. Was that the four-way? Or
no, it was just one-on-one.
I don't even remember that.
I remember Bradshaw working a long bear hug spot in the middle. It was not great.
That's what I love, man. I love bear hugs. Bear hugs. I love bear hug spots.
In the 2009 Rumble, he wrestled Cena, but it was when Shawn Michaels was his servant over the stock market crash or some bullshit.
See, that makes me laugh, man. I like it. Okay.
And then the whole thing was, you know, Shawn Michaels is poor, even though he's making $1 million a year as a wrestler. Which side will he pick? Will JBL fire him if he doesn't win the title? Just one of those deals.
Yeah, that did kind of suck, man. But anything that, like, makes Shawn Michaels subservient to another Texan makes me feel good. So, okay.
Side note, Shawn Michaels has also blocked me on Twitter. I wonder if they're in cahoots.
Dude, what did you do, man? I can't believe you must have slandered Texas or something. And do I need to block you too, man?
All right, Shawn Michaels, I get it. He probably thought it was an attack. I simply screenshotted a Raw 1997 show. It was his comeback show from the knee injury, and somebody in the crowd in Evansville, Indiana, had a sign that said Shawn Michaels can die. And I guess he thought I was telling him to die. Oh, well, you know, shit happens. It's the internet.
All right. So let me ask you before we go to Glenn, is JBL going to make your list?
He could sneak into my list just because the advancement up the card was so abrupt, but he made it work in the end. So, I mean, it takes a certain amount of talent to rise above that kind of fuckery. So I would give him credit for that.
Okay. Well, what about you, Glenn? Overall thoughts on JBL?
JBL's a hard one. There are some good performances. You've mentioned a bunch of them. His Eddie matches, the one match with Cena. His other matches with Cena, not as much. But every good JBL performance, I feel, is an incredibly surprising JBL performance. Because when I think of him, I usually think of those Undertaker matches, a lot of the mid-card matches he had after his run in the main events was over, the Batista series that he had in 2005 after the draft, which was not good at all.
But do you blame that on Batista or JBL? Because Batista sucked in 2005, man. He wasn't good.
Batista, well...
We'll save that for the Batista conversation.
Yes, okay. Yes, definitely. But JBL just has so much more crap. The Jericho feud was awful. The Shawn Michaels feud that we were just talking about was awful. The more matches with John Cena that he had because of it were very bad at a time when Cena was having great matches with almost everyone who wasn't the Big Show.
Wait, I like those Big Show matches. Man, I gotta watch all this stuff now. All right, I have now put JBL on... Let's put him in fourth on my watch list behind Goldust, Undertaker, and Mark Henry. Okay, cool. All right, just had to put him on my list. Keep going.
There are some good performances, though, and some good promos, so he may sneak in toward the end of my list. Overall, his return at the end of 2007, beginning of 2008, I was embittered about, mostly because it took him away from commentary, and he was transcendental on commentary at the time.
At that time, yeah, because later on...
At that time. Well, he's a shadow of himself now.
Okay, yeah. At that time, you're right, he was an amazing color commentator at the time. Now, me personally, I got him in my top 40 right now, just right above Adrian Adonis, so, you know, that could change. But you guys have given me homework. But he's definitely making my list, and I don't see many of the guys in my top 50 overtaking him right now. So, yeah, I definitely have him above someone like Edge, Marty Jannetty. Yeah, okay. So, yeah, he's definitely. I can't see him dropping out of my top 40, honestly, guys. So, y'all just saying he might sneak on your list makes me sad. But I gotta go watch these other feuds, man, because maybe the crap does overtake the gold. So we'll see. But either way, guys. We've ran down six wrestlers. We're going to run down six more, but before we do that, we're going to take a break and hear a word from Place to Be Nation.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which of course includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we now offer them to you on two great feeds, On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with clotheslines and headlines, main event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. And we leave wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the Our Vantage Point podcast, which features a potpourri-style look at wrestling history, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler podcast, Our Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and the Imaginary Stories. You can find all these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows plus others available at PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, thehistoryofwrestling.com, and Scott Keith's blog, Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlayStation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Subscribe on iTunes or on Android with your favorite podcast app. Established in 2013, the Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network is committed to providing unique takes on the rich and diverse medium of professional wrestling, focusing on its history and global impact, but also exploring the vibrant contemporary scene. The roll call includes Space City, an NWA On Demand podcast, This Week in Wrestling, Stacey and Elliott's Bogus Journey, the Super Apuestas podcast, the Military Industrial Suplex, Strong Style History, Puro Puri, and Psychology is Dead. Also, from the archives, the full catalog of great shows that provided a fresh look at classic wrestling, including Where the Big Boys Play, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, Letters from Kayfabe, Wrestling Culture, Pro Wrestling Super Show, Goodwill Wrestling, and many, many others. Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Only the best.
Place to Be Nation, welcome back. This is Will from Texas, and this is our new show, For Your Consideration. And I'm here with my buddies Steve Williams and Glenn Butler. And right now, we're focusing on the mid-2000s for the Greatest WWE Wrestler Ever Project. And guys, we've already talked about some wrestlers, Umaga, JBL, MVP, Mickey James. So let's move to our next wrestler. And this is a guy, he wasn't there very long. And the time he was there is kind of a blind spot for me. So Glenn, I'm going to kind of let you run with this. And that's Evan Bourne. And I know he came out like a bullet. Like, I mean, he was having great TV matches. Then he ran into some drug problems and then kind of disappeared. But why did you want to talk about Evan Bourne?
Evan Bourne is a guy that I did not expect to seriously consider for my list until I started thinking about talking about him for this show and kind of going back and looking up some of his highlight matches. He really did come out having good matches on the ECW, which some of the people that they brought up to develop on ECW kind of didn't, and some of them did after they left ECW. But Evan Bourne has, especially once he gets onto Raw, he has just a string of great matches. He had the famous match with Randy Orton with the Shooting Star Press into the RKO. He had his tag team with Rey Mysterio. The two of them fit together so well. It is such a shame that that didn't go on longer, but they had a tag title match with Miz and Morrison on Raw in 2008. He had his match with Jericho at Fatal 4-Way in 2010, where Jericho held his own in a really good match and put him over clean as a sheet. He had a match with CM Punk on the Draft Show in 2010. He just had this string of great matches. His Shooting Star Press, his calling card, was always perfect. People were talking about that from the time he debuted, that, you know, WWE didn't maybe want him doing that move until he showed them that he could land it perfectly every time. A lot more safely than some other people we could name. And so I think that really speaks to his ability. His charisma came through in those high-flying moves the way you want from a smaller high-flying style of wrestler. In terms of historical impact, in terms of longevity, he doesn't really get high scores there. In terms of history, though, he comes toward the beginning of WWE hiring the smaller indie stars before they really managed to push any of them other than Punk. And when he debuted in 2008, they weren't doing very great with pushing Punk at that point. But he still had a great impact on weekly TV. You could always count on him for a good match. He's the quintessential guy who could go back to the company today and be an absolute star on NXT. You know, like a Cassius Ohno or Drew McIntyre. But he does have deficits in terms of a list like this. He doesn't have the longevity. His promos, I don't think, ever stood out considerably. So I think he would have to kind of sneak onto the end of the list, which, after going back and looking up some of these matches and maybe watching a few more, I think he might genuinely do for me.
Well, let me ask you real quick before we move on to Steve. Are there any matches that, like, for me, I'm still doing my homework, man. My list might change a little bit from what I have right now. Are there any matches where you say, watch this match, and it's going to make you want to watch more Evan Bourne matches?
I would say the Jericho match at Fatal 4-Way.
Okay, that's the one I'm going to watch then. Probably after this show. I don't know, it's going to be that or the JBL Undertaker feud. Kind of. But, all right, Steve, thoughts on Evan Bourne?
I know he was there for a couple years. The only thing I remember about Evan Bourne is that he was in a Money in the Bank match at WrestleMania one year and the RKO from the Shooting Star. He's a guy who's immensely talented, lots of great memories of him working. However, none of those come from WWE. He is not making my list.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of my problem is I was watching the product when he was there. It just, when it comes to, besides that, the Shooting Star into the RKO, I can't think of anything that sticks. It's kind of like let's go with some other guys that we were talking about. When I saw JBL versus Eddie with the bloodbath, it stuck. You know, even just a feud, even some of those bad matches you talked about, Glenn, they stuck with you. Jamie Noble and even though I didn't remember her name, and Nydia, the duo, sticks with you, right? Little hillbilly with the little hot brown girlfriend. Then you got Umaga just destroying Cena's. It sticks with you. Ryback just murdering jobbers. I mean, guys, y'all recited the name of the jobbers, you know? And it's not just because we're nerds, it's because that kind of stuff sticks with you. MVP and his character stuck with you. Like, nothing about Evan Bourne just sticks with me. And I think that's the problem I'm having here. I mean, I don't know. I mean, do you have anything else to say about Evan Bourne besides watch the Jericho match before we move on, Glenn?
No, I would try to look up some of his tag matches with Rey Mysterio as well. Even being in there with Rey, of course, he's going to be high on all our lists, probably. But that was another good run for him.
Full disclosure, Rey Mysterio, my number one guy in WWE. So, anyway. Okay, well, let's move on to our next wrestler, and we'll talk about Rey Mysterio on another list. And we're going to go to, I would say, the lesser Rhodes brother, the lesser Runnels. Although I did just watch him in this past season on Arrow, okay? and he played this guy who could not feel pain. So that was interesting. Anyway, Cody Rhodes. Steve, you picked Cody Rhodes. I think I forced you to pick Cody Rhodes. I wanted you to talk about him. What would you say were the highlights and the lowlights of Cody Rhodes' career here at WWE?
Cody is one of those guys that has a sneaky long career. I don't remember exactly when he got called up. It was 2007 or 2008. But then he was around until last year, so that's a good 7 or 8 year run. Highlights, early on, he had his run with, I started to say highlight, but the more I thought about it, I changed my mind on the tag team with Ted DiBiase, where they were kind of fun characters at first, but then they became Randy Orton's lap dogs, and it fell apart.
That's all they were, after that. And they had a horrible feud with DX as well, where they just
But later on, he was a fun mainstay in the mid-card. There was the mustached Cody Rhodes. There was Cody teaming with Goldust in a really fun, old-school, fired-up, let's-get-Goldust's job back, fighting against the Shield guys.
Great feud. Great feud.
Oh, yeah. That alone showed me, you know, if given the ball, he does have some potential. I don't know how high he could go, but I think it's definitely worth – I think he deserved more than he got. Low light for me is easily – Stardust. It was something that would have been fine had it lasted 6 months, but they just would not let it go, and it eventually led to him leaving the company.
Well, you know, the strange thing about Stardust is it's weird, because I think Stardust could have worked, you know, if he didn't become a horrible wrestler.
Yes.
Stardust. It's like he completely changed what made him a decent wrestler.
And, of course, anytime you're partnered in any way, either wrestling with or against Bob Holly, that's going to be a low light in my book. Bob Holly is slightly above Hitler on my list of worst human beings of all time.
He had a great book, man. I loved his book.
We were just talking about JBL before, dude.
I never read Bob Holly's book. It's on my Kindle. I'll get to it one day. And I was a big fan of his in 2000, but everything before and after that, I just, no. I cracked open a cold one the day he was released.
Oh man, that's some hate for Bob Holly, man. We'll let you take over Bob Holly when we cover the Attitude Era. I got to hear that, man. That's wild. Hey, you know what? Was Bob Holly even nominated? Hardcore Holly?
I'm pretty sure he's in there somewhere.
I'm gonna look while you're talking about Cody Rhodes, Glenn. But I don't think he was. I'm gonna double check, man. Let's see. Attitude Era. There is no Hardcore Holly. There's Bob Holly. Never mind. All right. I was all excited. Ooh, I can go nominate another guy. No, I can't. Well, all right. Yeah. So we're going to let you talk about Bob Holly when we cover the Attitude Era, Steve.
That'll work, brother.
Strong word, man. Did he block you from Twitter too?
I doubt he knows how a computer works. So no. You'll have to go to the library if he wants to block me from Twitter.
Man, this is how long it's been since I've done a podcast. I was going to ask Glenn what his thoughts on Bob Holly were. But anyway, what are your thoughts on Cody Rhodes, Glenn?
My thoughts on Bob Holly were he had a pretty good team with Cody Rhodes. Cody is weird because he had so many gimmicks, and he really put himself into each and every one of them. For a while, at least, in terms of Stardust. But none of them really stuck as much as they should have. Like, I don't even know what mustachioed Cody Rhodes was about. Dashing Cody Rhodes was pretty fun. The vignettes for Dashing Cody Rhodes were really, really good. And then the turn that it took when Rey Mysterio kicked him in the face and he turned into demented Cody Rhodes with the face mask, that was some really good character stuff, and he had a pretty good match with Rey Mysterio coming out of it.
It was a great match, the Mania match. It was short, but it was great.
Yeah, so he's done some good stuff. He's had some good characters. He's had some good vignettes, and yet For me, he can't really escape this sense of blandness. On a community I used to be a part of that a lot of people in Place to Be are in now, we used to have what we called the Cody line, which was anything above the Cody line is good, and anything below the Cody line is bad, but Cody is just Cody.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, you know what? He's actually not in contention on my list. Like, and part of it is because I think he was a great tag partner to Goldust. Problem was is that Goldust, I have Goldust in my top 10 as well, full disclosure. Like, and I'm going to argue that point on a later show. But I always felt like, well, when you didn't have Goldust as your partner, it just fell apart. Whereas Goldust is like, Dustin Rhodes, honestly, between his WCW and WWE career, is one of the best tag workers of all time. Whether it's the Booker T tag team, his tag team with Barry Windham, his tag team with Cody. And now look what he's doing with R-Truth. He's like one of the most entertaining things on Raw in this feud, right? Even though they were in a know-nothing tag team, the Golden Truth, he's doing a great thing. But that's just me rambling on about Goldust because I love him so much. So anyway, I agree with you guys. Cody, not going to make my list. Steve, is he going to make your list, or are you just considering him?
I'm considering him. I think he's worth kind of a deeper look just based on the longevity. There may be some hidden gems there, but he's not likely to make my final cut.
What about you, Glenn?
I don't think he's that likely. No.
Yeah, I just don't think he has enough high-end single stuff. When he was primarily a singles guy most of his run. And I credit the high-end tag stuff to his brother. So, you know, that's where I stand on that as well. So let's move on to another guy who I'm going to give a spoiler here, will not be making my list. But I kind of like talking about him because he was given chances, but he was also a guy who had a string of injuries, a string of bad luck. And I don't think he ever reached his full potential, and that's Wade Barrett, okay? And so it's kind of weird because he led Nexus, right? And then after Nexus, he led the Core. And
right,
I thought...
Yeah, right into the ground.
yeah. But the point is that I thought that entire period was horrible, right? Like horrible TV, horrible live, except... The angle that, you know, kicked it off was awesome, you know, with Daniel Bryan choking out announcers and all of Nexus laying waste to who was in the ring at the time. I know Punk was in the ring. Who else was in the ring? Cena. Right? Cena was getting choked out. And so, like, that's kind of like, in terms of wrestling angle, that's his highlight. Whereas character-wise, as Bad News Barrett, he was awesome. Like, I loved, you know, Bad News Barrett coming up with his elevated podium or whatever, you know? I thought it was great. But then he became King Barrett, and I thought King Barrett was horrible. Like, you know, like, William Regal had just been King of the Ring a couple of years before that, and I thought did a great run with it. Sheamus had a horrible run as King of the Ring too. Maybe it was just that, like, didn't he have like deer antlers as a crown or something? Didn't he have some weird crown?
Did you ever watch the episode of Table for Three that they did, Barrett, Sheamus, and Regal?
No, do I have to watch it?
It's pretty good, especially for some of the advice that Regal gives the two younger guys. But I liked it for the observation that they got the three of them together because they were all kings of the ring. And one of them reflected right at the beginning of the show that they were three of the worst kings of the ring in terms of, you know, what they were able to build off of it.
That is absolutely true. I would say Triple H is also another one of those guys who was not a good King of the Ring.
Yes, Will.
Anyway, hey, come on. It's going to happen. Everything. Anyway. But then another low light, the League of Nations. Like, I kind of like the idea of the League of Nations, you know, having these foreigners run roughshod because I like foreigners in wrestling. I just, you know, one, I was bad booking, but it, you know, those guys, I don't know, man. It's like you have Rusev, who's great, Sheamus, who is great. Who else was in there? besides Barrett.
Del Rio.
Del Rio, who's great. All of those other three guys are making my list. And with was Barrett the leader? Barrett was the leader, right?
Well, Sheamus was the one who was champion.
Okay, but they had Barrett like as a mouthpiece, right? Then he got injured again, right? Isn't that what happened or something?
Yep.
And anyway, I don't remember. I just remember it like being really anticlimactic, and I was really depressed about that. But I kind of wanted to put Barrett on here because he seems like one of those woulda, coulda, shoulda guys. Like, you know, like for a while he was putting it together. You know, took the Misawa elbow. What'd they call it? What was his finishing move called?
The Bullhammer.
The Bullhammer. Look at you, Steve. That's why you're a trivia second place runner-up, dude. Anyway.
And his earlier finisher, the End of Days.
What was that? I don't remember that.
That was the, like, fireman's carry and, like, dumping the guy forward off of his shoulders.
It almost led to Mark Henry dying one time on Raw trying to take that move.
It also looked pretty bad when he did it to Vince McMahon, just because Vince is frail and old and may also have died.
Yeah, let's all right, so we'll consider that a lot. Well, I don't know. If you would have killed Vince, that would have been a highlight.
Shit.
Well, I'm just saying, man, that would have been pretty wild, right?
Could have, would have, should have.
I mean, you know, before the Benoit tragedy, Vince was going to die on TV, or he did die on TV. You know, this would have just been for real. Anyway, you know, kind of blurred the line between reality and fantasy. Anyway, let's move on from this morbid topic. So, Wade Barrett, not making my list. Glenn, anything you want to say about Wade, and is he making your list?
I'm a little surprised that someone like Wade Barrett, who was around for as long as he was, and was pushed to the level that he was at times, never got a title run out of it. You know, he had injuries and things like that that derailed him a few times, but still, it's a little surprising he never wound up with the title at any point. Wade Barrett's a guy who I never really connected to outside of, like, a couple isolated matches. Like, I remember when he was doing the Barrett Barrage, he managed to have, like, a good match with Randy Orton, I think, but then he got injured again. I think that was the time that Big Show threw Dolph Ziggler at him and broke his arm. Just a string of bad luck in terms of that.
Stronger arm.
Hmm?
Should have had stronger arms.
Well, you know, coulda, woulda, shoulda. Some of his promos were good, like you said, but overall it just does not leave enough of an impression for me. He's out of my list.
Yeah. What about you, Steve?
He is my single biggest what if of the last 10 years. They really probably should have given him the title pretty early on when they did the gimmick where Cena was enslaved to him or some nonsense. And they said that if Cena didn't let him win the title as a referee against Orton, that Cena would be fired. I thought a great little run would have been for him to win the title and then fire Cena anyway, and then Cena have to fight for his job back. But just one unfortunately timed injury after another, he really is easily knocked out of contention on my list.
Yeah, I think we're all there. But I did want to talk about him because I do think he had an interesting career arc there, you know? As one of those kind of guys that, like, you always hoped he would do more, and then when you look at his career, just really, you get deflated because it's so disappointing.
Yeah, he's also one of those guys who actively diluted the Intercontinental title by holding it approximately 7,000 times, like a Kofi Kingston or a Dolph.
I mean, I get that, but, I mean, when you saw the Intercontinental title during the Attitude Era, That title was already dead.
It was
no longer the springboard. It was no longer the springboard to being like a world champion guy, you know, that it had been for so many years. But anyway, let's go on to our next one. And this guy did have a great career. I mean, he has to be on all of our lists. I can't see him not being on everybody's list. And that's Batista. Okay. And Glenn, you wanted to talk about Batista. So definitely, for you personally, hit the highlights, and if you don't hit the ones that I have, then I'll add those. And and some of the lowlights too, including the Triple H feud.
None of my favorites are in that feud, to be fair. Batista holds kind of an interesting position for me, because I started watching wrestling in the summer of 2005 for reasons went into on another podcast, but I turned on SmackDown on UPN, and the very first episode of SmackDown I ever saw was the match where JBL won the multi-man match for the new SmackDown title, and then Teddy Long revealed that they had another draft pick, and it was Batista. And so my introduction to Batista was that they were presenting him as THE man, in all caps, and, you know, looking back in terms of history, that he had just won the title and he'd come up out of the Evolution group and had to prove himself and all that. You know, people can, various ideas about when he proved himself as a main eventer. But for me, starting watching at that point, he was THE man. And he was always really good at presenting that, at presenting himself as an important character. And in that era of SmackDown, which again might be damning with faint praise, he really was kind of holding it together. The show was about him. Now, his feud with JBL I count as a low light, and some of the stuff afterward as well. But he has so many good feuds, good angles and matches. The face turn against Evolution, he was so over. They were aching for him to turn face and win the title there, regardless of the match, kind of disappointing. His tag title matches with teaming with Rey Mysterio at the end of 05 and then again in 2009 fighting Jericho were so good. They paired together so well. His title match with The Undertaker, WrestleMania 23, one of the best WrestleMania matches ever, I feel. It was so surprising coming from the two of them at that time, but the pace that they struck in that match and the hard-hitting offense that they both brought to bear was so good. I watched that, I think the last time I saw it was a year ago, and it totally holds up.
I watched it maybe 2 or 3 years ago, and you're right. That's a fun match, man. I think Batista has quite a few highlight WrestleMania moments, like the Cena match.
Yes.
I forget which. I thought that was a great match. A little sloppy, but energetic. Both guys beating the shit out of each other.
Yeah.
The WrestleMania. Obviously, the match with Orton and Bryan.
Yeah, definitely. And his whole heel shtick in that era, as he was really good at the conquering hero babyface role, but he was so good as the douchebag heel too. In that whole feud with Bryan, in his final months in 2010, as kind of the whining douchebag heel, who had been the conquering hero before, but now didn't want to fight anyone, he could take those contradictory characters and play both of them so well. The Cena match at WrestleMania, I really like. The rematch at Extreme Rules, I think, was a little bit better. And so he was always, as well, a great presence in the Royal Rumble. You know, whenever he would come into the Rumble, there was a sense that things are getting serious now, that he's a real powerhouse in that match, except the one time people actually wanted Roman Reigns to win. But again, booking. I mean, there are, yes. If you want to talk about lowlights, Batista is a guy who has to have chemistry with someone. He had chemistry with The Undertaker in all of their matches. He had that chemistry with John Cena. He had that chemistry teaming with Rey Mysterio and then fighting him after he turned heel on him. You were supposed to be my friend. That's such a great character moment for him. When he didn't have chemistry with someone, it got pretty ugly. His matches with Edge, very bad. His matches with Randy Orton, very bad. His matches with JBL. That's not surprising,
because those guys aren't very good. Edge and Randy. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Yeah, well,
JBL match wasn't his fault. It was all Batista's fault. Sorry.
Okay, all right. bad storylines that he was in. I mean, at the end of 2005, there was a whole sexual harassment thing with Melina that was just stupid and cringeworthy and bad. When he came back from injury in the summer of 2006, he came back kind of, like, oddly cooled off. You know, he wasn't quite as over as you'd think he'd be coming back from injury, and that led to some disappointing matches with Booker. His promos were good enough to get the job done, but there were times that they kind of failed him. He didn't have the promo chops to make his Shawn Michaels feud in 2008 work after the Flair retirement, and so that got shunted to Jericho instead, which became a legendarily great feud. There were times at the end of 06 and the beginning of 07 where the company kind of lost confidence in him as a pay-per-view draw, and so they started bringing John Cena into the SmackDown pay-per-views. So he did falter at times, but his highs are so, so high that I think, for me, he's probably going to be in the top 25.
Wow, okay, and I could see that. I wouldn't even fault you for that. But I want to let Steve talk about this. But you didn't even mention his great heel turn after the Cena feud, like right before he left to become a movie star, where he was wearing like the douchiest clothes ever.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, that was, to me, that's like when it was like, it became so apparent. I mean, it's like exhibit A on why you should let wrestlers be themselves and let them stand and fall on their own merits, and then just give them bullet points and let them, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Batista was such a great douchebag.
Oh, and then his role in the new Evolution in 2014. I didn't even mention those matches with the Shield.
Right. Oh yeah. No, that was definitely a highlight, but just that one point in time, you know, and then to have that great run on his way out, just that point in time really highlights, because supposedly that's just him dialing it up, you know, like how Steve Austin is really, you know, the Texas Rattlesnake, and that's just him dialing it up. That's what Batista was supposed to be, that just him dialing it up. Steve, thoughts on Batista?
Well, you have that amazing babyface turn the first quarter of 2005, where he was the hottest character they had in years. And then on the other end of the spectrum, we have the douchebag heel character of early 2010 that we've been touching on. I mentioned earlier that I thought MVP was the most relevant character when he came into 2006. Batista filled that role in 2010. Here was this guy in his mid-40s dressed like Justin Bieber and just making himself so damn hateable. It was fantastic. As far as matches go, he's got the Hell in a Cell match with Triple H. Also had a good under-the-radar Hell in a Cell match with The Undertaker in 2007, I think. And the Hell in a Cell match with Hunter was 2005, excuse me. But also the SummerSlam 08 match with Cena was very good. I've had a decent match with JBL that ended with a spine buster or a powerbomb on the steps, I believe, at SummerSlam 06. He's got some good work in there. He's definitely making my top probably 50.
I got you. Okay, I got him in my top 40. And on the strength of really that great heel run for like 2 months, that's how much I thought of that. And then, you know, we didn't mention this, but he had some really good matches tag teaming with Eddie before Eddie passed away. Because remember, that was leading to the Eddie Batista feud. And then Batista teamed with Ray once Eddie passed away. So, you know, we got to mention things, you know, that he was a member of Evolution, which is probably one of the worst factions of all time. Like, just horrible. Like, horrible angles, you know. Grant, to be fair, you're right that a face turn was pretty good, but the crap we had to endure to get to that was just unforgivable. Deacon Batista, remember? I mean, he was Reverend Devon's like sidekick, which just seems so wrong on so many levels. And I remember him having bad matches with Kennedy. Am I making that up? Did him and Kennedy fight?
Yes, in 2007. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that being, but I don't even blame Batista for that because Kennedy sucked.
And I think maybe Kennedy took Mark Henry's place when he got injured before the Great American Bash 06 when Batista was just coming back. And then when Batista had the title, he defended the title against Kennedy at the 07 Royal Rumble, I think. And those matches were not good. No chemistry.
Wait. Yeah, it was. Okay, yeah, that's why I remember that, because I watched. No, wait.
Yes, that happened, wait, the Rumble you were at.
Okay. And then he had a chair match at the TLC with Taker in 2009, right?
That was their only bad match.
I know, because I was at both of those matches.
Well.
I was like, why? But I was like, why do I remember that Kennedy match being so horrible? Because it was horrible. Back to back with Test and Bobby Lashley, you know, surrounded by all these awesome matches. And those two matches, like, really stuck out as just, like, you know, horrible matches on a great night of wrestling. Anyway, all right. So, yeah. So we all think highly of Batista and definitely deserving, you know, and kind of. You know, when I started making my list, I kept putting them. At first, I had them like 60 to 70. And I was like, oh, no. I remember this Batista moment. Let me put them up in 50. Oh, wait. But then I remember this, you know, the Shield reunion tags. Okay, let me put them up higher. And then he ended up in the top 40. So kudos to him. So, Steve, we're going to move on to a guy you want to discuss. And another woulda, coulda, shoulda guy, man. And that's Bobby Lashley, you know. And I like some of his stuff in TNA, like, because I don't watch the TNA product, but I'll, you know, if someone says, hey, watch this match, I'll watch it, you know. But another guy that just seemed like he was destined for greatness, man, and it just fell short. But you chose to talk about him tonight, so what do you got to say about Bobby Lashley?
Yeah, it's odd to me that he was very obviously a Vince McMahon chosen guy with eyes on being the face of the company. But if you look at the timing of it, they already had Cena, they already had Batista, they had already had Orton, who was already proving himself to be a bit of a head case. But even with all these guys, they still chose to pluck Bobby Lashley out of obscurity and try to push him in this position. You know, he got the prime feud with Vince McMahon himself, even if it was on ECW TV and it ended with Vince McMahon as champion wearing a do-rag. It still happened. It's obviously big, yoked up guy. I don't remember if he was around much after Wellness became or after the Signature Pharmacy scandal where they actually started enforcing the Wellness policy.
I'm pretty sure he was, man. Like when Rey Mysterio and Booker and all those guys got suspended?
Yeah, there were like 12 guys in the fall of 2007 that got suspended.
And even before that, in 2006, when the Great American Bash got caught up in the elevated liver enzymes.
Yeah.
He was one of the ones who had the liver enzymes.
Yeah, it screwed up the whole damn pay-per-view. He was the reason I included him on the list was he was in the most promoted match on the biggest drawing show as far as pay-per-views go in WWE history, that being the 2007 Mania. I mean, you could argue that the Donald Trump involvement was the bigger drawing card, but in the end, it was him in that prime position. Match wasn't great, but he was given the ball and he didn't drop it. That being said, I don't see him making my list. The longevity is not there. The only real match I could point to say, hey, this was a very good Bobby Lashley match, was the John Cena match in the summer of 2007. I think it may have been the Great American Bash.
Okay. Yeah, and I remember that match as well as being kind of Bobby. That's Bobby Lashley's highlight match. But it's kind of one of those matches, because John Cena had an unbelievable run in 2007 where, like, he was having great matches, or even good matches with, like, the Great Khali. Obviously, the Umaga Classic. And I think usually John Cena gets credit for those matches, you know, but, you know, it takes two to tango, right? So,
I did see him improve greatly from his time in OVW and developmental. He got better, but a lot of that can be credited to Finley taking him under his wing those first 6 months.
Yeah, that could be. That's true. Yeah, and you got to see a lot of those. You have that unique insight, Steve. That's why I like having you on the show, is because you were there. You were watching all the OVW shows as it was happening there in Kentucky, right?
Oh yeah, from probably they moved it. I couldn't tolerate the look of the old Davis Arena on television, but once they moved to the new building in 2002, I started watching pretty regularly after that. So I got to see a lot of these guys as they came up, and then follow them obviously as they progressed on the national stage too.
Who's the other guy? He was older at the time. Ron Waterman. Wasn't he like part of that class?
He was right before that. He was there at the same time as Cena and Batista.
Like, he was another guy that was supposed to be like a can't miss prospect, but he never even made it to the main show, right?
No, I don't think he was there in developmental for 2 years. He got cut in 2002, I think, right as they started finally calling up all these long-term, the Batista, the Ortons of the world, the Cenas. At the same time, Waterman gets cut. I don't know what the story is there.
Oh, okay. Now, I just brought it up. Is Bobby Lashley making your list, Glenn?
Most likely not. That Cena match showed a lot of potential, but he left like pretty much right after it. He had that feud with Kennedy and then got injured and then mysteriously never came back from his injury. So
wait, you mean somebody got injured in a Kennedy match? No way.
Shocking, I know. Who could imagine? But he just never realized his potential. You know, the match with Cena was good. He spent a lot of time in 2006 fighting Finlay and William Regal, who are two very good people to be spending a lot of time with. And, you know, he did learn, he did improve, he got a little better, but the ECW run was just a bad fit for him. The style that they wanted on ECW and the people they had to work with him in ECW were just not suited to him. He needed to still be working with people like Finlay or Regal. And then he just up and left. So there isn't enough there.
No, that's fair. And yeah, he won't be making my list either. So guys, let's talk about the last wrestler of the show before we wrap it up. And I picked this one because I think he's one of the most important wrestlers in this modern era. And he's actually in my top 10. Misses the top five, but he's in my top 10, and that's CM Punk. Okay. And when we look at the guys that they're hiring now, the people they're pushing, whether you think it's good or bad, it doesn't matter. But does Daniel Bryan get pushed if CM Punk is not a success? Does Kevin Owens get signed? Does Sami Zayn make it to the main roster? Do the Shield guys, your Rollins and Ambrose, do they even make it to the main event? You know, I think all of that's due to Punk. You know, I mean, here's a guy, I mean, who clearly, you know, you had guys like Triple H, they were burying him before he ever had a match on, you know, WWE TV. But here's a guy who, despite bad booking, questionable angles, whatever, was always over. Like, whether he was a face or a heel, he was always over. And I don't want to really compare him to Daniel Bryan, but he kind of set the template for how you can stay over in spite of the company. You know, I mean, think about some of the highlights, like when he was doing the was it in ECW when he was having good matches with John Morrison?
Yes, sir.
And John Morrison, good singles matches are few and far between. You know, it's
yes,
not like
sir.
It's not like John Morrison was having like good matches with everybody. No, that's Punk. That's Punk knowing how to work a match. For me, kind of like on the main stage, his breakout was that Jeff Hardy feud in 2009. You know, basically calling him a drug addict and, you know, just cutting killer promos. I was there in Philadelphia for the Night of Champions, and Punk just cuts an amazing promo earlier in the show before the main event. Then they had great matches on TV, like they had a great cage match on TV. And then of course, the Summer of Punk, right? But before that, I thought that him forming the Straight Edge Society and being Straight Edge Jesus was like some of the greatest heel work ever. You know, I mean, there are reports, and I've seen the handheld footage, and a buddy of mine was there at the show, actually, where Punk was getting so much heat for that gimmick. You know, that was like when you hear reports of like old ladies yelling at him, "You're not Jesus," you know, and he was shaving people's heads. But there is a house show, I want to say San Francisco or around the Bay Area, where they were getting so much heat that it was going to be a 6-man tag, I think, that they were just littering the ring full of trash like it was the NWO, you know, and it was Punk just like egging them on. You know, you don't get that kind of real heat. Even this Roman Reigns booing that's happening, it's not real heat. It's a protest against the company. CM Punk generated genuine heel heat. And then when you flip the lid and you have like the Summer Punk, when Punk won that title, when nobody knew what was going to happen before it happened, right? I mean, Punk was going to quit. His contract was up. They were trying to rehire him. You know, I kind of lived vicariously through that whole situation. How many times in the last 15 years can you count where a title win really felt special? You know, and I mean that. When Daniel Bryan won the title at WrestleMania, that felt special. When CM Punk won the title, that felt special. What's another one? I would say, I'm having a hard time thinking of other title wins where it felt like it mattered. You know, unfortunately, I hate to bring this up, but like even Benoit winning at WrestleMania 20, like that felt different. Eddie winning at No Way Out 2004 against Brock Lesnar felt special. Like there are certain moments where like the wrestlers that you never expect to win, like when Rey Mysterio won the title, it didn't feel special, you know, and Rey's my number one guy. Cena's won the title, what, 20 times? None of them felt really super special, even his first title win. You know what I mean? Where it was like this moment in time that you just want to hold on to and cling to and kind of cherish the memories. That's how that title win felt, you know? And then he goes through this period of time, whether it's the Lesnar match, the Undertaker WrestleMania match, the Jericho series, horrible feud, great matches, where despite what's happening with the booking, despite what's happening in his personal feud with the company, he's always delivering. And he really, in my view, opened up the door for all of the guys that followed. I mean, Triple H is going to get the credit, NXT, and we're getting the best young talent in the world. But it was kind of like CM Punk who allowed that to happen because he defied the odds. Now, I mean, I got to admit, there were some really bad periods, you know, like the leader of Nexus. He had just come off the white hot Straight Edge Society. And to be fair, it was CM Punk's decision to disband the Straight Edge Society. But then he became the leader of Nexus, which was nothing. Then, you know, remember the Summer of Punk? It was like, okay, Punk, Cena, Rey Mysterio was in the world title mix. I mean, he wasn't winning the title, but he was in the mix. And then Kevin Nash powerbombs him. And then he feuds with Triple H. And Punk was so hot, Triple H has to pin him. Like, that was horrible. Then during his title run, like, there was some really bad booking during his title run. You know, but he still managed to get great matches out of it, regardless of what was happening. And I know personally that he was disillusioned. Like, he was just, his vision of what he wanted it to be and what it could be was being blocked. And he was really frustrated with that. So, I want to throw a question out to you guys, and you know, you can agree or disagree. I don't mind, but for me, he's the best promo in the scripted age. And when I mean scripted age, I'm talking the last 15 years, you know, where where you have to hit your lines in script. Probably because he's not scripted, but it doesn't matter. Like, he believed in himself enough to kind of stand in the company and say, okay, I'm going to do my promos, but still hit those points in those feuds. Do you think he was probably the best promo in the last 15 years? And then you can tell me what your thoughts of are on Punk, and then after that, I'll ask you guys where we're going to rate him. So, Glenn, we'll go with you first.
That's an interesting question. He's absolutely a great promo. 15 years catches a few years of Eddie Guerrero, who was also such a great promo, could make anything absolutely compelling.
That is absolutely true. But Eddie Guerrero, even as like a great promo, you know, the only thing I can think of is the cage match promo before a SmackDown cage match with Ray, you know, that would even like be on the level of like that, the pipe bomb promo.
Yeah. And Punk even has equivalent things.
Most people don't even remember that promo, the cage match.
And Punk even has equivalent promos being a creep to raise children, which was a lot of Eddie's great heel work in 05. So, Punk, absolutely. I mean, you could spend hours running down the highlights. The lowlights, like you said, are there. All the Johnny Ace stuff is not good.
No.
But he still managed to have good matches during. I mean, he was doing awful promos with Johnny Ace every week on Raw, and then he would have matches with Daniel Bryan. So, right, like you say, he always like got the best out of it.
And I don't even blame him for bad booking. You know what I mean? Like, I don't blame any guy except Triple H for bad booking. You know? So, I don't know, man. I think he is, though. I mean, think about this, Glenn. Eddie Guerrero was the only guy that even came to your mind for the last 15 years. You know what I mean?
Yeah, true.
Who else?
I mean, I think Cena's a pretty good promo, but I'm not going to put him over Punk in that department. And I mean, there are people who make things compelling, and there are people who make things interesting. I think Kevin Owens is someone to, you know, to watch for on promos. But again, with the consistency and longevity of Punk, that's a very fair case that you make for that. And I think on this list, he rates highly in every category. In matches, in terms of promos and character work, in terms of longevity, in terms of angles, in terms of work rate, you know, he has to rate very highly in everything. I think, you know, putting him in the top 10, like you said, is very defensible for me. You know, at the very least, top 20.
Oh yeah, see, I mean, think about this. For me, in the last 15 years, there are three promos that are better than any other promo out there, and that's the Eddie Guerrero Steel Cage promo. I forget the date. It's like September, October of 2005. I want to say September, with Eddie standing behind a steel cage. But it still doesn't have the longevity or the lasting impact of the pipe bomb. And then there's the Mark Henry retirement. You know, to me, those are like the promos, the angles that compare. That's it. You know, to just that one pipe bomb. You know, what about you, Steve? What do you think about Punk?
I wouldn't argue against him being the best promo of the last 15 or so years, especially once they started getting so scripted. And a lot of it is him just blatantly defying the orders and, you know, going off on his own, which has resulted in just amazing, memorable work. He is easily in my top 15. He was my favorite wrestler for years at one point. The new Nexus is probably the low light, either that or that weird period in 2007 where he was with the ECW New Breed, but not really. Luckily, that didn't last too long. Put together some very good matches, is an important pioneer, as you said, and a lot of the other guys who made their names on the indies getting signed. I'm not personally a friend of CM Punk. He probably couldn't pull me out of a lineup. He did. I did share a locker room with him for a brief period, though, when I was training and doing some wrestling with Ohio Valley Wrestling. That was near the end of Punk's run in developmental. So I got to see him interact with people down there, watch the blatant cynicism in Al Snow, basically thinking he was never going to amount to anything. So on a personal level, it was quite satisfying watching Money in the Bank 2011, where he got the single loudest crowd reaction I've ever heard in my life. So Al, fuck you for that, buddy.
Yeah.
But he's a lock, easily a lock.
Damn it, I had my microphone on mute and I was talking and I was like, anyway. But, you know, I actually had him in consideration for number one. I think maybe the only thing that hurt him was longevity compared to like some of the other number one contenders. Right. You know? And then that was it. And even then it was like he was still there for what? 6, 7 years, 8 years, 9 years, I don't know, something long, you know, 10 years. It couldn't have been 10 years. Whatever.
He got called up middle of 06 and disappeared after the 14 Rumble. So not quite 8 years.
Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, to me, like, he almost single-handedly with that Hardy feud and that Straight Edge Society run, almost kind of reignited my interest in the company, you know, because I'd kind of fallen out after the Benoit tragedy, and it kind of took CM Punk to get me back into it, you know, seriously. So kudos to him for that as well. And I really wish that they would let more guys go off on a limb like they let Punk do, you know. I mean, that's rare, because I think we would see more moments that were intriguing, special, etc., if they did. And to me, that's an indictment on the company, not in any particular wrestler that's working right now. But, fellas, I think we gave plenty of food for thought to the people that are listening. Steve, I'm glad you did the show. You know, dude, I honestly thought you won that trivia contest, man.
Well, I'll get him next time when we do our big rematch 7 years from now.
I just remember you went on that run, man, where you just like nailed like 10 questions like in a row, bam, 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 like you were fed the questions like beforehand, like the old 21 T quiz show or something, you know?
You know, leave it to me to know the name of the Jurassic Powers in New Japan Pro Wrestling in 92, but then not know the name of the two nerds from the 97 Rumble commercials. You know, I would get stumped on something stupid like that.
So who are the two nerds in the 97 Rumble commercials?
There's these two fake superfan guys named Adam and George. Trust me, I remember the names now because it cost me the damn contest. But,
dude, why would any freaking wrestling nerd even remember that crap, man? Like, I don't know, man. I don't blame you. You're our trivia champion, okay?
Oh, well, thanks, man. I appreciate that.
Steve and Glenn, what's coming up on a Place to Be Nation for you, buddy?
Well, like you said at the beginning of the show, each and every Wednesday morning, you can find the Wednesday Walk Around the Web, a link roundup for things I find interesting or entertaining in some way. And
I love. Hey, let me just say real quick, I love the walk arounds because it cuts off so much time just like scrolling through Facebook feeds, you know, like I don't even have to worry about that crap because I know that you'll cover it on Wednesday. So there you go.
Hey, I like doing it. I'm glad for anyone who likes to read them. So that is every single Wednesday morning, 9 a.m. sharp, no matter when I get around to posting it on Facebook and such, at placetobenation.com. And you never know when another Spectacular or some other podcast might be coming.
Yeah. Well, you know, I know you and me and Nate Milton did the Rumble Weekend podcast, and I really enjoyed that. That's why when Steve and I were kicking around looking for another person to do the show with, like, you were the guy, you know? Like, I have my pro wrestling only buddies, you know, my buddies Chris Zellner, Johnny Sorrow, and Pete from the Titans. They're all going to do these shows with me. But I was like, man, I like talking to Glenn. Let me make sure I get him on. So we'll try and definitely have you back on to do some more of these for your consideration podcasts. And if you think we missed a wrestler that you want us to talk about, let us know. But we're gonna kind of jump around. We're gonna do some themes, not just talk about the eras, but we also might talk about guys who were better in other companies and compare them in WWF to like either ECW or WCW. We're gonna do a highlight show on a wrestlers that kind of cut their teeth on NXT, and maybe they're on the main roster like Nakamura or Sami Zayn, but since NXT work counts for this this poll, I kind of want to dive deep into the NXT rosters. And we might even do like tag teams. We'll talk about the Dudleys and the Usos and the Hart Foundation and Killer Bees and, you know, a bunch of other tag teams. So we're going to cover plenty of wrestlers, even from this era. They just might be under another show. But for everyone who listened, I hope you enjoyed our first For Your Consideration podcast. And I'll be back to do more of them. Until then, I want to thank Steve and Glenn for hanging out with me tonight. Everyone else, bye-bye.